It's Halloween time, and all across the country, folks are lining up to get scared to death at their local haunted house.
Today, Peaches Christ gives us a sneak peek at her new attraction, Terror Vault, a fully theatrical, immersive haunted show where guests participate in a twisted tale of horror located in the historic San Francisco Mint. The haunted house is full of creepy zombies, weirdos, ghosts, and of course, the scariest devils of them all, drag queens.
Listen as Peaches Christ joins us to talk about her inspirations from filmmaker William Castle and how she's dreamed of haunted houses since she was a kid.
Plus, why parents are the most likely to poison their own kids on Halloween.
And kicking with the legends at Wigstock 2.0. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
And this is Feast of Fun.
Feast of Fun is made possible because of fabulous people just like you. Thank you. Unlock a delicious world of podcasting magic and listen to thousands of amazing shows at feastoffun.com/plus.
Is this Peaches Christ?
Is it you?
Yes, it is.
I'm your biggest fan.
The biggest fan in the world.
Like 300 pounds?
Yeah,
he's not big. Just my heart's gotten big because of the sweet, sweet Cheetos I keep eating. How you doing?
Good. How are you guys?
Good. Have you recovered from your summer in Provincetown?
No.
No,
I don't think so, because I sort of got back and hit the ground running, working on this haunted attraction, and I got sick last week.
I'm sorry.
Actually, I feel better today. So, but yeah, yeah. It's almost like it's
like Feast of Fun is medicine. You know, we're just curing you, right?
Maybe.
You're looking forward to it, and you're just like, I feel better already.
That's right. That's exactly right.
Well, should we do some vocalization exercises to get you to loosen your throat?
No, that doesn't seem to be a problem. My throat's plenty loose.
Just go, oh, oh, oh.
How have you guys been?
Oh, we've been pretty good, you know.
Girl, we got stuck in Canada and we had a hitchhike back home. It was terrifying.
Oh, my God.
If you're going to get stuck anywhere in Canada, it should be a college town that specializes in training young men and women for hockey.
Why is that?
Because there's great butts everywhere.
Wow.
So I was, you know, I was a very resourceful, stranded person, let's just say.
You made the most of it.
You were stranded in Canada. How do you get home?
Well, you rent a car. So that, you know, we had this old jalopy. You rode in it. I mean, we even had McStole in it. And Fausto just had this idea. He's just like, we are going to ride this car until it dies. And I said, okay, we're going to ride this car until it dies. And I'm like, we're taking a road trip. And if it dies on the road trip, it dies on the road trip. He's like, well, maybe we don't want to take the road trip. But I'm like, we're taking the road trip. And so we took the road trip, and it died in Canada, and they said it needed a new engine, and it would be like $3,000 to get the new engine. So he's just like, okay, well, let's do it. And I'm like, whoa, hold a second. Let's talk to our mechanic. Maybe we should just get another car rather than
spending. And he said, oh, Fausto, eso no es bueno. My mechanic's Mexican-American. You know?
Yeah.
Alverardo, which is he has the same name as Big Bird had on Sesame Street.
Oh, really?
And he's tall.
And is Alvarado?
Alvarado.
Oh.
Alveraldo. Sorry, Alveraldo. Okay. And so I call him Big Bird because he's this tall Mexican guy, you know? And he's like, oh.
And he wears yellow feathers. It's the weirdest thing. Yeah, so we just, we abandoned the car in Canada and just rented a car back. And, you know, it's very expensive to rent a car that's going to cross the border and you're going to leave it in the border, you know? So.
Oh, what, right, yeah.
So I was at truck stops, you know, trying to make money and stuff. But I can tell you, you know, Canadian men are very polite. Even when they hate your guts, they're just like, oh, I don't think that's such a good idea.
Would you say that you would describe yourself as a trucker sucker?
I'm a people person. And I like to make people happy. Mm-hmm. And I'm a middle child, not of just my family, but of society. Mm-hmm. And I think at the heart of all artists is that need to sort of want to connect, either in a good way or in a terrifying, horrifying way.
Okay.
It's Halloween time right now, and a lot of people pay a lot of money to get scared to death.
Yes, that's true. I mean, it's a thriving industry, as I've learned the last few years putting this thing together. It is a big business, the business of scaring people, you know, because there's a demand for it.
Well, you've been scaring people for a long time, though. I mean, anybody who's seen your movies,
That's true. Well, I've been, I've loved horror movies for years and years. If that was some sort of attempt to be shady, no, I don't care.
I mentioned All About Evil, and, it's
a horror film.
You had that t-shirt, and I don't know if you still sell it, and I would wear it, and it was a picture of you, and people would see it, and they'd be like, oh, look at this wonderful drag queen, and then they would scope out the rest of the picture, and it's you with somebody, is it Martini's head on a platter? And so you would go from this joy on their face to, like, utter terror.
Right. Yeah, it was me holding Martini's head on a platter. Yeah,
it was a great shirt, and I loved wearing it because it just you got to see people's reaction change as they checked
that
it out.
That is vintage couture, honey. That's probably like an 18-year-old T-shirt.
Oh my god, I don't know if I have.
You could sell that on eBay for like $1 million.
You could sell that for like $5.
I think it's time for a reprint.
We were doing t-shirts, 20 years ago, and it was all kind of considered a laugh. Mm. Isn't this hilarious that it was almost like we did it ironically. Mm-hmm. And now drag queen merch, much like haunting, is big business.
We did merch and we did t-shirts very early on just because it's like that's what bands did.
It's a great way to get your stuff out there because people are fucking wearing your face.
Mm-hmm. In the early days of Drag Race, we actually would tell told Pandora boxes and
some of the other girls.
So the girls was like,
sell some t-shirts. Sell some merch.
They were like, no, thank you.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we loved merch from way back. I mean, we had one design, Peaches Christ is My Homegirl, which was like a knockoff of that 70s design, Jesus is My Homeboy. And that shirt, we did like 5 or 6 printings. We had sweatshirts, tote bags. Animatronic once wore it in a photograph that ran in Rolling Stone magazine. I think merch is great because it's essentially an advertisement of your persona or your show or whatever be worn by people. What better endorsement is there?
Very true. And it does support the artist. So, you can visit feastoffun.com/store and get your t-shirt or mug or tote bag today.
Wow. That was sort of shameless. We were having a conversation.
Well, we're still having a conversation.
Oh, okay.
It continues on.
And then really
we have merch at peachesChrist.com. Excuse me. Don't interrupt my plug, please.
Where was that?
Excuse me. Could everyone be quiet for a moment?
What website? What?
I'll wait until there's silence. PeachesChrist.com, thank you, is where you can pick up your next drag queen merch.
And tickets for your shows, right?
Tickets for, although the Terror Vault, because of the partnership I'm in, I had to form a new production company with my business partners. We are obligated to go through Eventbrite, which is a different ticketing agency.
Mm-hmm. So tell us about this Terror Vault. This is a brand new direction in your career.
That's right.
You're not in drag for this at all.
No, I am.
You
Peaches
are.
Is in the middle of the show.
How else is she going to scare people?
Yeah, hello. I'm the scariest part.
Scary talented.
Mm-hmm.
You think I'm going to be offended by your little attempts at shade, but I'm not. I get it. Peaches is scary. She intimidates people. She is fierce, okay?
This time, the horror experience is twice as scary as before.
Well, this is, it's an immersive walkthrough theatrical experience, much like a haunted house, except that there are scenes and stages and it's a mix between sets and mazes with a big giant escape room finale. Mm. So it's a combination of things kind of all put together to create one giant show.
So it's like a haunted house. People are traveling from room to room, but it's like, yes, once they get to the room, it's just not, they're not just like looking at things and maybe something's going to pop out. Like there's, you know, there's a floor show. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. There's a story and there's a script and there's a beginning, middle and end, and it's site specific. So I wrote the script so that it takes place at the historic San Francisco Mint. Mm-hmm. And so it's, I mean, I love haunted houses. So I took my love of haunted houses and kind of merged it with my passion for theater and storytelling. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of haunts are kind of random, or there might be a theme, but in general, you might walk into one room and there's a vampire, and you go into another room and, you know, there's a guy with a chainsaw or whatever. This is not that. This is a fully realized story, you know, with actors basically taking you through it. Mm-hmm. It's a journey. I think San Francisco is a very haunted city, full of haunted places. But we, unlike Southern California, who has a ton of these attractions, tons and tons, so many, and they're very successful. San Francisco proper doesn't really have a haunted attraction that's become, you know, like an annual tradition. And so I've just had this dream of putting something like this on for years and years, but it's not easy to do, which is why there hasn't been one for a while.
Well, the city, you know, because you're in a city, so you're doing it in a city, and that can be very hard. Most of the haunted attractions, like here, let's say in Chicago, are out in the suburbs, because for a lot of this, you know, you need space for people to go through. You need, you know, places for them to park their car, you know, and they're big to-dos.
And, yes, exactly.
But you got a location, which just sounds just fantastic to me.
Yeah, that was part of it. So what I did was I partnered with a guy named David Flower, who is from the East Coast. I met him in Provincetown last summer, where he was building haunted theater, haunted attractions, but they were more like plays. And I looked at his stuff in Provincetown and was blown away by the production design. Mm-hmm. He is just like an artist who creates these installation pieces, just beautiful, spooky sets and props and things. And I said to him, oh my God, I've always wanted to do this in San Francisco. Do you have any interest? He said, look, San Francisco would be the perfect place to do it, but no one can get one off the ground there. If you can do it, I will join you. And so I came back to San Francisco at the end of last summer, so 2017, and approached this company here in San Francisco called Nonplus Ultra. And what this company does is they activate city buildings on behalf of San Francisco that are someday going to be reclaimed by the city for use. So, for example, the San Francisco Mint building is set to become a museum in the future. But in the meantime, instead of it just sitting empty until they fundraise or, you know, go for it, this company comes in and turns the space into an event venue where, like right now, they have big Dreamforce convention, and there's a big tech company who's taken over the top two floors of the building. So they're making money for the city in a partnership with the city. And so they have the San Francisco Mint, the Palace of Fine Arts. And so I basically just went in and met with them and gave them this whole pitch of creating a production company with me and partnering so that I would always have a venue somewhere in the city, and that they would, you know, be partners with me in creating these immersive experiences. And it worked, and we put together a business deal, and lawyers got involved, and we, you know, had contracts and all the business that it takes. And David Flower and I started basically planning the show last winter. And then David moved from Provincetown to San Francisco in June. So we actually switched places. And David and our production team have been building the sets, you know, based on my script since June, you know. Wow. So it's a big project. It's the most ambitious thing I've done since making a movie, you know, just as far as the size of it and the risk involved financially.
I can imagine that this is probably going to be one of your best works of art, in the sense that you're putting a lot of your experience and knowledge of what it takes to get into people's minds, and your love for the camp and the silliness of drag and camp culture. It's going to be really a great experience for the people who go to see this.
I hope. I mean, I think I'm really straddling the line between exactly what you just described. And I think Peaches fans are going to be surprised at how scary it is. And, you know, Haunt fans or people that aren't familiar with me might be surprised by how much comedy is incorporated into it. You know, it's not just we're going to try to scare you at every turn. We're also going to try to make you laugh and, you know, and trick you and fool you and play with your expectations and senses. And, you know, and we really are like, you know, going fully 4D with it, you know, so that you are immersed in every sense of the word, including actually scent. You know, we're changing the smells of the different environments. And
so when you're sort of developing a lot of the experiences that people are going to have, I imagine that you're sort of going down sort of a laundry list of, or literally a laundry list of people's real life anxieties. Like Mark and I went to this one haunted house, and the funniest and weirdest room was this dirty laundry room where there was this woman there, and she's like kept going, I gotta wash the clothes, dirty laundry, so much dirty laundry.
She kind of looked like Harley Quinn a little bit with the pigtails and just screaming dirty laundry at us, and we're like, it was so scary.
I love that. Mm-hmm. See, you know, there's the jump scare, you know, where you don't expect it and they just jump out at you. But there's also this sort of creepy, lingering scare of like, what the hell was going on with that person? And what kind of room was I just in? I love those kind of scares.
And it also can be fun, too, when they read you a little bit, like we were walking underneath this. And I think they said this to me, like, because somebody was above us, standing above us over a grate, and like, he's balding on top. And you're just like, fuck you. I still have all my hair.
Most of it.
Really? They were reading you?
Well, oh, yeah. Yeah.
I
don't know if it was me or if it was the person I was with, because I have a pretty full head of hair.
But you right. can turn, well,
you know.
It's an interesting challenge for, I mean, we've started rehearsals, and there is a script, and the actors have dialogue, but a lot of what's happening in the show is improvisation. And so we're both working with the script, which I'm describing more as a blueprint. But I want the actors, I mean, imagine performing the same scene 37 times a night. You know, that's how many times we'll do the show in an evening. So I want them to find different ways to do it and to feel empowered to change it up. Otherwise, I worry it could become stale.
It never occurred to me that a lot of the actors in haunted houses have to do the same thing over and over and over again. So improvising becomes a key element to keep it fresh, not just for the audience, but for them themselves.
For sure. Yeah. Well,
the other thing, too, is like we've talked to one of our guests before, Kristen Studdard. She did one of the haunted houses located here in Chicago. It was the old Joliet Prison. And she did it as a teenager. And she said it was really physically hard sometimes because you had to contort your body sometimes, or you were stuck on stuff. You were tied down. You were there for hours. And she's just like, it was rough.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot about that, you know, scare acting and, you know, basically how to protect your voice and stretching and taking breaks. And, you know, we've built a break into it in the evening, which a lot of the haunts don't actually do, you know. And ours is a 6-minute push through, meaning that a different group of people goes through the attraction every 6 minutes. Some of the push-throughs are 30 seconds or a minute. You know, you've been to those haunts where, so for the actors, it's like a constant, you know, conga line of people.
Oh, yeah. Is there a sexy ghost that seduces someone?
Mm.
The but it's like, I'm horny.
It depends on what you consider sexy, but because of this, the storyline, you know, there are, I mean, the whole thing, the whole concept is that the San Francisco Mint, you know, was built in the mid 1800s, and it, at one time it housed a third of the country's gold, and it was one of the most important, you know, buildings on the West Coast. And at the, you know, time of the 1906 earthquake, when and the entire downtown city of San Francisco was crumbling and in flames, the Granite Lady is what they called the San Francisco Mint, stood strong because they intentionally built her on granite, and she was made of stone. And so it's this really warped, twisted story where the people in the Mint actually locked themselves inside as people perished in flames outside the doors. So after the 1906 earthquake, when the city really became the season of the witch, as that book details, where it was corrupt, it was full of mobsters and serial killers and cult leaders, and San Francisco really got its identity for being the debaucherous, crime-infested city that, you know, that it was known as, they didn't have a prison anywhere that near the city because Alcatraz wouldn't be built until, you know, 25 years later. So the San Francisco Police Department, who was overwhelmed and whose jails had run out of room, did a deal with the federal government where they actually secretly turned the San Francisco Mint into a prison, and they used the vaults to lock people up. And so when Alcatraz was built, years later, instead of moving the prisoners to the island, they actually just sealed the vaults and walked away.
What? They took the tombstones, but they left the bodies?
They just left the bodies.
They sealed people in to die?
Well, Fausto, yes. I'm a writer. This is my premise.
I was like, oh my God, that's so gruesome.
So you learn all of this in a spooky Mint tour when you get to the show. And I'm not going to reveal too much. But not only do you learn all this going through the top part of the Mint as a museum, but you learn about who the prisoners were. You know, one of them was Antonia LaCrouster, a satanic cult leader who used an army of children to find her human sacrifices. That's where trick-or-treating came from. Guess who's playing Antonia LaCrouster?
Who?
Me.
Oh, I thought it was Martini.
No. Martini. She's playing one of the trick-or-treaters.
Well, it's a very important thing to, when you're doing these haunted houses, to have the location itself, the building, to be a character in itself.
I think it's true if you have a building like the Mint. Sure. A lot of times these experiences, you know, are in sort of generic spaces like empty shops and strip malls or whatever. And in a way, I think you have to be even more creative because you have to overcome the fact that your like haunt is sandwiched between, you know, Kmart and, you know, whatever grocery store. So I'm really grateful that we have such a historic, you know, significant location. So for me as a writer, just getting to walk through that building over and over again, and then to actually read the real history of it and learn about the real history of it, and then to be able to warp that history to create a horror show that you're going to, you know, it's basically a horror movie that you're going to walk through, has been a total blast.
Has the Cabin in the Woods influenced your work? I mean, 'cause I feel like that's a very important horror film in the past 10 years.
I mean, I really liked it. I don't know if it's influenced my work, probably.
Because in a lot of ways, the film deconstructs a lot of the tropes in horror films. And so what I really loved about The Cabin in the Woods is that sort of it spelled out all the, like, you know, the teenage sex and the secret lab and all these other, you know, things that happen. And you think you're watching just a regular old horror film, and it turns out to be something much bigger. And right. I'm wondering if in some ways, like, this experience that you're having is like going in deeper into that horror haunted house experience.
Yeah, probably. I mean, in a way, I think what I love to do is sort of play with people's expectations and create twists and turns and, you know, make people laugh, but also kind of surprise them and scare them. I would say that this, like a lot of my stuff, is actually probably more traditional storytelling. Mm-hmm. And my goal is to, instead of you just walking into a room and seeing something weird, in this sort of scenario, you're actually going to understand kind of where you are in the story, mm-hmm. and the space of it, and understand what's happening, you know.
Well, it's kind of like, you know, in some senses, it's the difference. You know, you can watch porn, right? And you can certainly get off on it. But like, you could also like read erotica, and they both kind of have the same result. But there's something different about it. It's a different kind of, yes. approach, and it gets you a different way.
It's exercising a different part of your mind, mm-hmm. in a way. The way you have to do more of the work, mm-hmm. and in some ways, it's a richer experience. The way it's living in your brain.
Do you feel like you get more scared, like in a haunted house, than you do, let's say, watching a movie?
I think it depends on the person. Yeah. That's been my experience. Like, for me, I definitely get more scared going through a haunted house. Like, I still, like, we went to Universal Horror Nights, me and David, last weekend, just to kind of see, like, you know, what the big guys are doing, because they have a bazillion dollars, and mm-hmm. you know, they're doing 8 mazes in one night, and, you know, and I went, and it's kind of predictable, you know, because the mazes sort of kind of follow the same formula, but still I found myself like just totally screaming and jumping and not wanting to go around corners. Like, I completely suspend disbelief and, you know, and allow myself to go on the journey. In movies and stuff, I've noticed, unless the movie is really, really good, it's easier for me to sort of disconnect if, you know, I don't want to be, I don't know, frightened or something. You know, it's, I'm more easily distracted in the cinema or something. But in the haunted house, I'm more like, oh, my God, where's the next person coming from? You know,
they're there. I think the most disturbing thing that happened in the last horror house we went to is they had us lay down on the floor in this room. And then all these balls, like the balls that they have in these, like those kiddie playpens, the
Chuck E. Cheese balls, kind of thing, yeah.
came and rolled all over us. And so we were underneath these balls. And I knew they weren't going to get rid of these balls until at least somebody stood up. So I'm just like, okay, this is not really fun for me. I'm not like really scared, but like, I know it's not going to end until somebody stands up. So I'm just going to go ahead and stand up. So I just like stood up and then.
Well, they smell really funny.
That's such an interesting thing.
Well, they turn the lights off. You know, and have you lay down, and then all of a sudden you're under, you know,
a couple of feet alive. Of, yeah, you're buried alive with Chuck E. Cheese balls, and you know, some kids pees all over it.
Well, my thing is more like, yeah, like, you know, in San Francisco, God, people are such wimps. Like, I don't, it's so funny, you know, doing this project, because I think they'd be like, I'm not laying down on that dirty floor. You know,
yeah.
It might not be sanitary. Did you clean the floor? Is it disinfected?
Is it vegan?
Yeah, is the floor made with vegan wood?
Yeah, so I would imagine, too, that it was a huge time sucker, too, because there was a lot of preparation for that little room and all that kind of stuff like that, too.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. I actually really admire that kind of creativity, though, mm-hmm. because, see, that's the opposite of what Universal was like, which is, we're just going to push you through these mazes like cattle. And they have tons of money, and it looked beautiful. Like, the Poltergeist one they did was amazing. The set pieces were amazing. But I would be, like, stopping and looking, you know, at Carol Ann's bedroom, like, in awe. And then there's someone there with a flashlight, like, gesturing aggressively, like, move on.
Mm-hmm. Go into the light, Peaches Christ. Go into the light.
Yeah, well, they were more like, just get through this maze so we can get 10,000 more people through it, you know. Whereas, wow. like, the kind of haunt where you're asked to lay on the floor and have balls put on you. No, that's my kind of haunt.
What about 1960s horror thriller film producer William Castle, who would put the audience in chairs that literally electrocuted the audience.
He's my biggest inspiration. I mean, yeah. That's really where, you know, I was introduced to William Castle through my obsession with John Waters, and William Castle is really who inspired me to create my show Midnight Mass, which was to take movies and to give an added experience. So, you know, William Castle has always been, for me, like the ultimate showman that I kind of have aspired to be like. And one day, this is an amazing little story for me. It wouldn't necessarily mean a lot to other people, but John Waters told me he's friends with William Castle's daughter, and she lives in the Bay Area. She lives in the North Bay. Yeah, her name is Terry, or one of his daughters. Her name is Terry Castle, and she runs the estate. And Terry Castle told John that she felt like Peaches Christ was the closest thing to her father's legacy that she knew about.
Oh my God!
As far as someone, yeah, and that to me was like the and to be told that story from John, you know, the man who created Odorama, and you know, has always been an idol of mine, was really like very, very special. So, in a way, I think Terror Vault and Into the Dark are all also in the realm of something William Castle, you know, could have or would have done.
Mm. What was the first haunted house like that you ever went to?
Well, I grew up going to the beach, spending summers in Ocean City, Maryland. And we had a place down there, and I would live down there. And as a kid, I mean, a little kid, I was totally and completely fascinated and obsessed with a haunt at the end of the boardwalk called Morbid Manor. And it looked just like the giant, like a giant version of the Psycho House. I'm going to send you guys pictures of it because I collect them. And Morbid Manor was in the early 80s, in the 80s, when I was a kid, I would sometimes ask my parents if I could just sit when everyone else was touring the rides and playing the video games down there. They would put me on a park bench and I would sit and watch Morbid Manor and watch the people going in and out of that haunted house for hours and hours, completely fascinated. And I did not want to go in for years. Mm. And then finally, you know, I got up the nerve to go inside, and I would dress like the characters in Morbid Manor. They wore these like black sort of ghoul, like, basically gowns. And so I would be that for Halloween. I would wear makeup in the summertime, put grease paint on my face, cover myself in blood, roll around in the ocean. I mean, I was totally and completely bizarre.
Is it still there?
What's that? No, it burnt down in the 90s and I was devastated. But there's this woman that comes to my shows in San Francisco, and she's a little bit older than me, obviously. And she and I were talking, and she said, you know, I need to tell you, I worked at Morbid Manor.
Wow.
And I was at a big Castro Theater event. I lost my shit. It was as if, like, Elvis Presley had walked into the building, you know.
Did she knew you I were could fascinated not believe with it? It? Did she already know?
She had heard in an interview that I was obsessed with it. And I, you know, just couldn't believe it. And so I probably really, really annoyed her because I asked her tons and tons of questions and, you know, we've become friends and she's excited about coming to the Terror Vault and stuff. But like, I still idolize those people who put on Morbid Manor. I thought it was the coolest thing I'd ever experienced. And so then when I was 12 and 13, and I was putting on these haunted houses for our neighborhood, you know, it was my version of Morbid Manor.
Mm.
Is there like a legality of shocking people? Like, do you have to get them to sign waivers in case somebody like dies of a heart attack or something?
No, I mean, I think it's like anything else. You know, if you go to a horror movie and you have a heart attack, or you go on a roller coaster. I mean, we have a warning. We have warnings up, but no, I don't think so. I think people have to be responsible for themselves.
Didn't William Castle have like nurses in the lobby and ambulances parked outside?
Like a circuit party.
Yes. Yes, but you know those weren't real nurses, right?
There were actors in nurse costumes.
Yes.
So
yes.
If somebody actually needed a nurse, they'd be like, I'm sorry, man.
Yeah, it's true. But when we did drag queen roller derby at Midnight Mass. We actually did have the audience all sign release of liability forms on their way in.
Does that so make it more terrifying? Like the fact that you're like, you might die? Because when Mark got on Alt for Norga, he had a sign like, he might die. We may be shipping his body back to you. What's the address? You know? And I'm right. Like, what are you guys planning on doing over there?
Yeah. I think that's probably a different liability for the production company. Whereas, you know, an amusement park, you know, there's a certain inherent, you know, agreement between the person buying the ticket and, you know, them getting on a roller coaster. It's like, you know what you're getting on, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, a lot of people die on roller coasters.
What's that?
A lot of people do die on roller coasters. Right, but more often than you
really
realize.
Hold the amusement park responsible.
Right.
Unless the roller coaster goes flying off the tracks, mm-hmm. of course.
And that happens a lot more often than you realize. Like, that's the thing about it is, like, when I was a kid, there was this terrible roller coaster accident, and I think, like, it affected me. Like, I read about it in the newspaper, you know, or at least my mother read it to me. And then we went to one of those, like, you know, carnivals and stuff, and they had a woman who was beheaded, but she was mysteriously kept alive. And everybody's like, oh, it's just a cheesy thing. Nah, nah, nah. And I was a little kid, and it freaked me out. And it was meant to be terrifying, scary. You know, Ripley's Believe It or Not, Fiji Mermaid kind of thing. And to me, seeing this woman with, you know, her head obviously in some sort of, you know, fish tank to make it look like she's just beheaded. And she was just kind of like tapping her music. It was a commentary on like the sexism that society puts upon women's bodies, that it's like it was more important to keep her body alive than her head alive. But it also was this like really grotesque, strange smelling carnival attraction that basically was just a person standing there not doing much of anything.
Right.
And that's the magic of like of these kind of horror experiences, is that it recontextualizes something that's very mundane or ordinary, and it turns it into the realm of the supernatural, like laundry.
Well, it's interesting with the heightened popularity of these experiences, like that there is obviously a sociological psychology at play. I don't really pretend to understand it, but clearly there's a lot of people turning out for this stuff in large numbers. What used to be kind of maybe a more niche interest is hugely, massively popular now. Mm. The horror genre is, you know, at an all-time, you know, high as far as the numbers of people that go to see horror movies, that go to these haunted house attractions, these haunted theme parks. Every theme park in the country now has a haunted version of itself at night. You know, this, if you track even the popularity of Halloween in American culture, it's never been a significant holiday the way it's become in the last 30 years. So there must be some sort of sociological or psychological component to it. My guess is that when the world is in chaos, that maybe these experiences are sort of a safe way to let off some steam, to exercise fear, to scream. I think screaming is a release. It's often followed by laughter. You know, you go to these haunts, and I was noticing this group of queens behind and David, and we were going through the Stranger Things maze, and it was like some women and then these gigantic gay boys. I mean, they were huge boys, like 6-7 feet tall, like big boys screaming like women at every freaking, there was like 1,000 Demogorgons popping out at you, like at every turn, and every single time these queens would scream and then burst into laughter. And it was sort of joyous. And one of them like screamed so loud when this Demogorgon ran at him that I turned around and the queen had like fallen to her knees and was rolling around on the ground laughing. Oh, you know, God. And the actors are all looking at her like, what do we do? You know? And I was just thinking about it and I was like, this isn't just about horror. This is about there's something about this release, this sort of anxious, you know,
It's tension and then the release.
Exactly. Exactly. Like there's something probably healing about it that maybe we need.
It mimics an orgasm, right? Because that's what an orgasm kind of, is. Yeah. It's that tension and that release, tension and release.
What is it? The French call it the great death and the little death.
The petit mort.
The great orgasm. Death is dying and le petit mort is an orgasm.
Mm.
But it was really interesting to me to be at something like that show. And you know, I go to Knott's Scary Farm, or I have, because Elvira has performed there. And as much as there's screaming, there's also, I think, that much laughter, you know. And laughter, as cheesy as it is to say, I mean, it's healing, and we need to laugh. And I think as the world, you know, gets crazier and crazier, and the news is darker and darker, and we're inundated with things to actually be afraid of, you know, to actually have nightmares about, going to these sorts of things is a release.
Thinking about that, like the last 30 years, and you say like the, you know, Halloween has just become such a much bigger kind of thing. I think it's because, you know, people are making money off of it. Like we have had the slasher films, you know, we had horror in the 50s and 60s and the 70s, but it wasn't until the 80s that it really kind of became a thing. And then I was just recently in Target, and the rows for their Halloween items and the stuff that you can buy, you know, may have been like, 30 years ago, one aisle. Now it's like seven aisles of Halloween.
It feels like half the store.
You know, it's almost like you're going through your own haunted house, just going through the aisles there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you know, it hasn't happened with other, you know, holidays, right? So it's something specific about spookiness and Halloween and, you know, and also just, yeah, the world of horror, the number of movies, TV shows, it's just, it's a huge, huge thing. And Americans in particular crave it. And it's not necessarily the same internationally. I mean, most countries don't have Halloween. When even the UK and things that are really similar to us culturally, you know, it's just definitely not as big of a thing, or it's just starting to become something. So it is sort of specific to American culture. And certainly countries like, I remember when All About Evil played in Israel, and I got there and the film festival had brought me. My brother was living there at the time because he's a diplomat. And so I was staying with my brother, and they said, oh, yeah, this is the theater where your movie's playing, with this teeny tiny little screening room. And I was like, really? Like, I'm you know, halfway on the other side of the world, and the movie's in this tiny room. And the film festival programmer goes like, oh, yeah, like Israelis don't like horror movies. So, you know, I was kind of like, well, what am I doing here? And I said, well, you know, what's that about? And he said, well, you know, like if you grow up, you know, serving in the military and facing some of the, you know, the gore and war that we've, you know, dealt with, like there's no need or interest in seeing it played out on screen. So, you know, I do love kind of thinking about what's the psychology behind it and why an American culture is this so big. And I think partly it's because of a fear of, you know, the world that we, you know, are basically living with all the time. I mean, I think a lot of it has to do with American media.
Well, and you see these horrors and whatnot. You know, it kind of reminds me of the story that I learned in French class. They had the French Cardinal Richelieu, who had his own private, you know, Catholic army, and he was, you know, basically controlled the French government with his, you know, his tactics. He would figure out how to hire which men for the debaucherous jobs of torture and whatnot, and he would, like, get them into a room, and he would show them pictures and see which ones they were attracted to. And the ones that were attracted to, like, the gore and looking at the gore and examining them, he wouldn't hire them. He would hire the ones that were attracted to, like, the pictures of, like, a mother with her child in a home. Because he would examine what they were looking at, because he felt like if they were looking at this, it was something that was not new to them, or it was something new to them. And so he wanted, like, you know, the most evil, craven kind of people.
Right.
Yeah. I don't know how that works psychologically, but I.
So if you're saying like he was trying to find evil people, and so the people who are into wholesome images were more evil.
Yes, because it was something.
They're bored by the gruesome.
The gruesome stuff is stuff they had seen before, so they had more. Because they're like, a mother with her child by the table. I wonder what this is like.
So they're like, what is right? What is a hug like? Such a foreign concept. Well, you know, ultimately the most evil thing in the world is ourselves.
Is that right?
Yeah, there's been studies there.
Have you been reading Reddit about yourself? Is that what it is?
Ourselves as human beings, like we are the most likely person to poison our own children with razor blades and apples. Like any time, you know, you ever hear those stories of like, don't take, you know,
candy
apples
from strangers
or something that's not wrapped because it's more likely to be poisoned. The majority of the time, it's the parent poisoning their own child that is usually the culprit.
Mm-hmm.
So we are our own worst enemy.
Well, I wouldn't poison a child, but I know that there's a lot of parents out there that do it. And they do it, you know, for different reasons because they, you know, hate their children. They want attention, that kind of stuff, right?
All those sort of urban legends about like, remember what a big panic it was in the 80s, like parents having to check all your candy?
Yeah.
It's like, seriously, like, is it really that hard to figure out who gave the apple with the razor blade in it? Like, you know what I mean? Like, really? Like, this was something like American adults actually took seriously and like obsessed over. Like, oh, I can't let my kids trick or treat because, you know, people put razor blades in apples and stick needles in candy bars. It's like, really?
And apples were the worst things to get when you were trick-or-treating because they were heavy, you know?
Yeah, and also, too, who the fuck wants an apple?
I got apples at home.
Worst thing to get in a trick-or-treat bag is a box of raisins.
Oh, those were terrible.
I would agree with that. Yeah. Box of raisins, apple.
I wasn't really appreciative of the pennies either. People would give you pennies.
Yeah, that was a thing in the 80s. Raisins, apples, pennies. I would just take that shit, throw it right back at them, walk away.
you had neighbors who gave you like full-size chocolate bars. Like those were you always go to that person's house first.
Yeah. Yeah, my mother is really into being like what's the word? The popular lady with the candy.
Oh,
like
your mom is so great.
She buys tons and tons and tons of candy, and then sits there and takes pictures of all the kids as they come. And I see like she's giving them handfuls of candy bars. I'm like, of course they love you, you know.
Doesn't she know you can't buy love? I was reading a newspaper. I was reading an article online about our neighborhood, which is Andersonville. And they have some, you know, we're on the not so nice side of Andersonville. But there's some very rich people that live across the street. And they were talking about what their budgets were for giving out candy at Halloween because they literally bus kids into this neighborhood. There's thousands of kids. One guy said he buys about 2,000 units of little tiny things. So we kind of read them like, God, this is cheap candy. He's like, listen, I had to buy 2,000 of them. And there are a lot of them. Their budget for candy for Halloween to these kids that they don't even know is like $600 to $700. Yeah.
Well, I have to say, that's the way it should be.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, it actually makes me feel kind of good that those wealthier people are showing up for that. That's nice because so many, I mean, I know we're talking a lot about American culture, but so many wealthy Americans are assholes.
Convicted of assholism.
They are, though, right? I mean, money corrupts, and a lot of the richest people, like, they don't want to deal with, you know, poor kids coming to their neighborhoods or whatever. So that actually, that's such a great thing to hear, you know, that those people are, you know, showing up for that.
I bought candy like a couple years in a row, and I gave up because, like, after 20 minutes, I was out of candy. And it was
just, really? See, we don't get any trick-or-treaters here because the way the buildings are set up in San Francisco, like you'd have to get through a gate.
Yeah.
Get buzzed into a door.
Don't come near me.
Yeah.
But Foster's really good with the kids, though, sometimes, too, because he'll get dressed up in a costume, and the kids will come around, so he'll have the candy, and he'll go to put it into their bag, but then he'll act like he can't really see, so he keeps moving the candy, like, is it over here? And the kids get really frustrated, and the he'll go on for, like, 30 seconds to, like, a couple minutes,
yeah.
Which, like, seems like it's a long time, and the parents are just, like, laughing, and the kids are just getting so frustrated.
Well, I also look demented, too, yes. Like, you know, you want some candy, kids? Let me get that for you. Where's the hole sticking in? You know, and the parents are like, oh, you're so crazy. You know.
Oh, my God.
And so it's about slowing down the experience to connect with the people of the good world that we live in, I think. You know? And you are in San Francisco. You're having a haunted house. Are you going to have poop on a long staircase?
You know, when I went to this national haunt convention, it's the biggest haunters convention.
Is that the one in St. Louis?
Country. Yes, and it's called Trans World, which is so funny to me. Because everyone who heard I was going to Trans World was like,
it's about time.
Yeah, they were like, get it, Miss Thang. And I'm like, no, it's actually, that's the name of the haunt convention. And I have no idea why, but that's what it's called. And so when we were at Trans World, there was an entire vendor who specialized in making turds and turd, like, paint and
turd and poop. Turd accessories.
Yeah, and I bought, like, a bowl full of turds that this person had made. But it's funny because I was saying to, you know, David Flower, I was like, you know, shit in our haunt would not be effective whatsoever, because you literally, you know, are going to have to walk through it just to get to the haunt. You know, the streets of San Francisco are so fucking filthy that that's just not scary here. You know,
well, what's going to scare the San Franciscans?
Part of our, you know, daily life.
Are you going to basically tell them that they have to, like, take public transportation to work instead of those private Google buses? Or are you gonna, like, say Trump gets appointed for a second term?
I mean, it's really, really sad here right now that all of those jokes are, like, you know, real. You know, there's, well, like, this scary, sort of economic disparity in San Francisco that's so bizarre and dark. That it's very real. Like, there is a whole class of people. Maybe that's what made me feel good about your story about the rich people, you know, giving out the candy, because there's this whole new financial elite in the Bay Area who actually want nothing to do with the rest of us, you know.
Well, you got to get them to come see your show. Corporate rates.
Well, believe it or not, we have one corporate buyout where they bought the whole haunt for the night.
Well, there you go.
I know, and part of me is like, I guess it's good because, you know, we're making money. And this other part of me is like dreading it. I shouldn't even be talking about this publicly.
you want me to edit it out?
It's not something I don't think you need to really figure out how to embrace it, because you're an artist and you need to make money, too. And if they're willing to spend money on your art and support you, I think it's super important.
And I think that's absolutely true. And you know, I have friends who work for Apple and Facebook and Pixar. And, you know, I have friends who work for the big money, you know, companies. So I am certainly not one of those people who believes all techies are bad at all. But on the other side, I will say there is a culture here. And maybe because we're knee deep in Salesforce right now, or whatever they fuck. Dreamforce or whatever it's called.
Dreamforce.
You know, that's what this convention's called that's happening here right now. It's massive. And, you know, it takes over the city. And, you know, I hate to say it, but there is a stereotype of sort of just shitty behavior, you know, that exists in this industry. But I guess you could say the same thing about drag queens. You know, someone could say drag queens are bitches. Mm-hmm. And I have to be like, yeah, that's true.
You said it.
So, you know, maybe I'm a hypocrite.
Well, how do we not be bitches? I mean, it's easier said than done, but why are drag queens becoming difficult? Or
I don't think they're becoming difficult. I think drag queens have had a reputation for being bitches for since the beginning of drag.
Do you think Renata Alumni would be a good drag name?
Renata Alumni.
What?
Never mind.
I don't know, Peach. No. Like, for me, the reason I got into drag is because of drag queens like you. Like, you know, you're very much like people. You very much like the people that I had in my community here in Chicago and in Texas that inspired us to dress up in women's clothes and, you know, scare the normals, so to speak. It was to be glamorous, but it was also to sort of rebel and to bring a very subversive element into our humor. And, you know, and I don't know, like, if that's always, like, on everybody's minds these days. They're more like, especially a lot of young people, there's this rejection or embrace of RuPaul's Drag Race, and it's this monolithic, huge entity that just defines everything just by its sheer size and volume.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's all unprecedented, right? I mean, like, yeah. You know, they just won the Emmy Award. It is huge. I mean, it is truly now you can say drag has gone mainstream in a way where even a few years ago I was arguing drag isn't mainstream. Drag's not mainstream. It's like, well, I don't know. I think it's pretty mainstream now. You know, we're all living in a new era of drag, and I don't know. I'm kind of just, you know, trying to keep an open mind about it all, and certainly focusing on sort of the positive side of it, which, you know, is that I think drag queens are now afforded opportunities and a spotlight that they just never have been before.
Do you think, like, we'll be looking, I mean, I guess we won't be around, but like 100 years from now, people will be looking back on these days and be like, you know, sort of the same way we look at the pageants of the 1940s or 50s and with a lot of nostalgia?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that's already happening. You know, doing Wigstock was very much a collision of all of that because there were so many of us who had done Wigstock before, but it was 20 years before. And then there were people there, you know, young people who had only grown up seeing Wigstock in a movie or whatever. And so it was really interesting that sort of that part of that weekend or that day, you know, that day, it felt like a whole weekend, but it was one day where there were a lot of us there who were just, it felt like going to a reunion. If that makes any sense. Like, you know, I mean, there were people there I had not seen for almost two decades. And we were, you know, all kind of reuniting. While also this sort of new school of drag. And I have to say, you know, of the young queens, Jinx and Sharon and Alaska and all the RuPaul girls that were there were so, what's the word?
Reverent.
They were so thrilled to be there, and they understood the magnitude of seeing, you know, Flotilla DeBarge, Mona Foote, Joey Arias, you know, Sherry Vine, Candace Kane, like that these people, you know, were legendary, like truly legendary, you know. Floyd was there, you know, it was amazing. It was an amazing day, and I hope Bunny gets to continue it. You know, Bunny called me this morning, actually before you guys did, and I almost didn't pick up the phone, and I did, and I was like, kind of wondering, like, is this a, because you don't know, like, I mean, you know, sometimes she calls and she just doesn't say anything of significance.
She makes rat noises.
Yeah, and other times she calls and she's inviting you to fucking Wigstock, you know, so you got to pick up the phone. But today was one of those where, you know, I think she told me I had AIDS or something, and, you know, it made no sense. And, you know, she talked about how her hole, I'm not even lying, how her hole is super loose, but it's not because she takes big dicks. She's the only bottom she knows who doesn't like to get fucked, but she's loose because of the size of her bowel movements. This is what she told me on the phone
nice.
An hour ago. This was our conversation.
What she does when she doesn't, when she gets bored with the conversation or she doesn't like what she's saying or what we're saying, she just starts pressing the buttons on her phone. So it beeps. So it beeps at you. And sometimes you can have a whole conversation where like every other thing is a beep. And you feel like you're talking to that captain from Star Trek that couldn't speak and he could only beep one for yes and
Pike.
Two for two.
But I'll tell you a secret. If she doesn't ever want you to end the conversation, so if you say something like, oh, because I was telling her that I had a call with you guys. I didn't say it was you guys, but I just said, I have a call coming up, and she just hung up the phone.
Okay,
she'll just hang up on you.
Is that her? Was that her calling just now?
Yeah, it was actually Lady Bunny calling me on the little line.
No. She's was making really? The round.
She's like...
Ooh, she must have gotten a big pile today.
Ask her about her gigantic call and why it's so loose.
You want to call her back? Because, Peaches, we know you have to go, so...
I do, unfortunately. Yeah.
Well, it was so good catching up with you. I'm so excited for this next chapter in your life. I think it's going to it's a huge success. I know that this is something you're very passionate about, and I love seeing people pursue their dreams.
Oh, thank you, guys. And it's good to talk to you. And
well, I want to go to it.
We're going
to
try it.
Yeah.
Also. We'll figure it out.
You let me know.
Yeah. Manish.
Can I come and scare people?
Yeah, I'll throw you in the show.
All right. I'll see what I can
Dirty
do.
Dirty laundry.
No makeup required.
Is it Monday through Friday? Is it every day of the week?
It's staggered. The first week it's Wednesday through Sunday, but then as it gets closer to Halloween, it's more like every day.
Well, you have a good Halloween and a good scary season, and I'm sure the Terror Vault is going to be a huge success, and it's exactly what San Francisco needs.
Thank you, guys. We'll talk to you soon.
Okay, bye, darling.
Unpleasant bye-bye. Dreams.
Peaches Christ lives in... Sorry.
Go ahead!
Peaches Christ lives in San Francisco. You can check her out at peacheschrist.com and check out her new Terror Vault, and you can get tickets available on Eventbrite.
Where the most terrifying thing is your subconscious mind. Mm. What horrors... dwell in the hearts of men. The shadow knows.
It sure does.
That was a radio show that was very a precursor to the Twilight Zone.
Mm.
They're rebooting the Twilight Zone.
Yes, they are with Peele, right?
Yeah. So that looks pretty darn good.
I'm very excited about that.
I'm a little, as a graphic designer, as a visual person, I'm a little peeved that they redone the font of the Twilight Zone into basically Helvetica Noir. Thin.
Oh,
and I'm
really?
Like, oh my god, would that font just die, please?
Mm.
I'm like, it's what they do to make things look modern and fancy.
Mm.
And to me, I'm like, the classic Twilight Zone logo that breaks into a million pieces is such a visual, powerful image, and that surrealistic opening. I love that they're actually, you know, turning it into a sort of a 4K with computer rendering and really giving you this gruesome eyeball blinking at you, coming at you in the screen. But, you know, they redesigned the Twilight Zone logo, so I'm a little bit not having it.
It'll be all right.
As Cher says about Madonna. No. So Cher was on the Ellen show doing a game show, and she... I guess they asked her what three people she would like to do a duet with, and she struggled a little bit.
She said Adele, she said Pink, and then she said definitely not Madonna. And you're kind of like, why just, you know, focus on the, why, you know.
Positive,
you know.
That's kind of funny.
Yeah,
right?
It's kind of, and I think she just kind of did it for fun. You know, and they were just at the Women's March together hanging out not too long ago. You know, what was that, 2 years ago? So, I mean, they have some kind of relationship. But then when you go back and you look at other things, like videos from her from the past in like the 80s and 90s, it's like she said some pretty, you know, shitty things about Madonna. Maybe Madonna deserved it. She said that she was incredibly rude.
And insecure.
She's like a spoiled little brat, and she's like, I don't understand why she would have to act that way. That kind
she
of
has
thing.
So much. Why does she have to pretend like she has so little?
What did she say? She has a great imagination and talent, but she's not a very good singer or something like that. It's kind of funny.
She's not very beautiful. And then she goes, you know, and I think Nadia Ginsburg like woke up in the middle of the night like my Madonna log senses are tingling.
There's a disturbance in the force.
Well, that's a, like, like, we were at a diner and this guy comes up to us and he's just like, did you hear? Like, he's listening to the podcast and he's like, leans in. We're having like a sandwich and fries. And he's like, did you hear about Cher and Madonna? Cher was on the Ellen Show. She called Madonna a bitch.
I was like,
that doesn't sound right, you know. Mm-hmm. So I googled it. Of course, it was a lot less innocuous. Mm-hmm. But it is really funny to see these extremely talented, iconic women sort of be catty with each mm-hmm. other.
Yeah,
why is that so much fun, Mark?
It is fun.
What are we going as for Halloween?
I don't know yet. I have to decide. I have to look and see.
I was thinking of going as a sexy Handmaid's Tale. You know, because that red robe, you can just kind of flash people, mm-hmm. you know. But I don't like those white blinders because they get
in the way.
You're going to want to take them off, you know. And here in Chicago, it's tricky because Halloween can get really cold. And so if you're thinking of going something that's going to show a lot of skin, then you're going to be freezing to death mm-hmm. if you're going to be outside. Conversely, if it is cold outside, it's going to be warm inside. And you want to have something that's showing off your skin. So something that has different layers or something that can be taken off, like a fur coat, can be really practical. Well, we went as barbarians 1 year.
That was great because we had fur.
And the fur kept you warm, but you also could like show skin. Mm-hmm. So it was like a little best of both worlds. And another year we went as sexy skeletons.
Ooh.
And the nice thing about the skeleton costume is if it was too cold outside, you could put a little bit of protection underneath.
Mm-hmm. You could do that. And also, too, it's like it's skin tight.
But my all-time favorite costume of Halloween was when I went as Superman, Lady Bunny, and Trixie Mattel all rolled into one. And my Trixie Mattel makeup was so good that I went to parties and people thought I actually was mm-hmm. Trixie Mattel, yeah. which was really weird.
And they didn't realize that your pads were pads and not your actual body.
And so,
like, these people were not familiar with drag at all.
No, and so to me, I'm just going like, do you really, and this is probably Trixie Mattel's reality, is that she's going around and people go, that poor, unfortunate man with the very feminine body and large breasts. And
mm-hmm. I think it was they were kind of surprised that, you know, you were only charging $5 for a blowjob and not 20 like Trixie gets.
Well, I'm surprised that they would lend me money. I was surprised that they would lend me money. I was, you know, asking people for $100 or $1,000 and they said, sure. I said, just come after me. My email is TrixieMattel@gmail.com.
I want to remind folks we can't do this podcast without your support. So if you're not a Plus member yet, sign up today at feastoffun.com/plus. We also have t-shirts for sale in our store at feastoffun.com/store.
Mark, what do people get when they sign up at feastoffun.com/plus?
They get access to 14 seasons of our podcast. Do you think this is the only podcast we've ever done with Peaches Christ? Guess again. We've been talking to her for 10 years now. Just I think probably this October is our 10-year anniversary. As I'm guessing. I feel like it was 2008 we became friends.
It's not Halloween without Peaches Christ.
No, it's not.
And if you are near San Francisco or you're planning to go, check out Terror Vault. You go to mm-hmm. PeachesChrist.com and get your tickets, honey, because mm-hmm. it's going to sell out and it looks amazing. And of course, if you're in Chicago and want to hang out with us on Halloween, send us an email at mail@feastoffun.com, or you can hit us up on social media. Feast of Fun.
Maybe we could all get march in the parade together or something.
That'd be fun. Yeah. Ooh. What is the parade?
It's on Halloween. Always on Halloween.
Where does Halloween land in Chicago this
when
year?
When is it this year? Is it on a Saturday?
Computer.
Halloween is on Halloween? Wednesday. That's a good day of the week for a Halloween.
Oh, very easy to get to.
So everybody will party on Saturday night, the 27th, but we'll be going to our friend's Halloween party on the 28th.
Yeah, it's going to be good.
Well, all right.
I got to get my looks together, honey.
We have
some amazing podcasts this week. Remember, Feast of Fun is available where all fine podcasts are put into the internet, like iTunes and other channels and opportunities. And of course, we have a YouTube channel where Cooking with Drag Queens with Peaches Christ.
Woo, coming up soon.
It's coming up very soon. And we, of course, are developing a Patreon page where we have a lot of behind-the-scenes footage and nuggets. And that's all coming round the corner, honey. We want to thank you so much for listening to today's show. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Fillion.
Bye, everyone. Bye-bye.